This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal joins us to discuss the death penalty. It's been 25 years since the publication of his highly acclaimed book, Live from Death Row.
Mumia was framed up in Pennsylvania on a murder charge. He spent many, many years on death row. No one is more qualified to talk about what that kind of torture means than Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Attorney Jim Lafferty shares his thoughts on the U.S. government's espionage charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange.
If Assange is extradited, which he likely will be when the decision comes down on January 4th, and sent to the Eastern District of Virginia for trial as a spy, it'll mean the end of national security journalism.
Nadia Ben-Youssef from the Center for Constitutional Rights shares their vision for the first 100 days of the Biden administration.
You'd have to be naive to think that the Biden administration is going to be any better than what preceded him with Clinton, Bush, and Obama. The Center for Constitutional Rights has developed a far-ranging program to combat what we anticipate and to make this a better society.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Journalist and activist Mumia Abu-Jamal spent 40 years on death row in Pennsylvania. As listeners will recall, in 2012, his death penalty sentence was overturned by a federal court, and he entered general population. While on death row, Mumia published 13 books and numerous commentaries on issue of social justice and the carceral state. In a special interview, Mumia Abu-Jamal joins us to reflect on capital punishment and its relationship to our modern society.
Hi, Heidi. How are you?
I'm wonderful. The question is, how are you?
I am well. Thank you.
Mumia, I couldn't help recall that it's been 25 years since you wrote Live from Death Row. And with the federal government's spree of executions since July, tell our listeners why Americans should care.
Well, think of it this way. Most of us go throughout our lives without really making contact, personal contact, with a government. You know, you might get a ticket, but think about this. If you're on death row, that's your government consciously, repeatedly, daily trying to execute, to kill you. And that matters not whether you're under a state death penalty or a federal death penalty. It's still your government, isn't it? So you're paying taxes for the government to exterminate you. And they place you in a condition that can only be called torturous. Solitary confinement, forced isolation.
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Most death rows function under 23-1 system, or you're locked in 23 hours a day, and you'll have 1 hour in a cage. I know that's how it was in Pennsylvania for many, many years, and then it became 2 hours in a cage. You know, every system is different, but it does the same thing. And also, you know, if you really sit back and analyze who's on death row, politicians in the media will tell you all the time, anytime you want to hear, that it's the worst of the worst. Well, it's hardly that. It's really the poorest of the poor, the weakest of the weak, those who could not afford a decent attorney. and were therefore thrown to the whims of the government. I remember reading an article about death row. Of course, I didn't need to read an article about it, but being a nerd, that's what I did. And there was a guy named Robert Johnson, I believe his name was, and he wrote an interesting collection of academic articles on death row. And his analysis was that the government created conditions so torturous, so punitive, so destructive, that the idea was to force someone to want to be executed. And, you know, once they made that mental snap, it's easy to execute someone who's not fighting against you. That's what torture does. And this is state torture by the government. Your tax dollars at work.
Mumia, in Live from Death Row.
This is a call from
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
You wrote that U.S. prison systems are, quote, human waste camps, where humans are transformed into what you call non-persons. As a society, what must we do to change this? And I'm curious if you think that the Black Lives Matter and other street uprisings are helping to shift the national psyche.
Well, I think they are because they're putting things on the table that have been kept in the attic and in the basement and therefore not on the table. And that is, I think, in sum, mass incarceration itself. You know, people are sent to prison to make them disappear, to get them out of our sight, out of mind, and therefore in a kind of invisibility, a prelude to non-existence. Well, Black Lives Matter, by raising the value of Black lives, all Black lives, has changed that equation significantly, I think, or at least that's part of their struggle. And there are numerous groups, right, who preceded Black Lives Matter, who were local or even statewide, like Decarcerate in Pennsylvania, like in New York, All of Us or None, and other groups who don't have the visibility, right, of Black Lives Matter, but have been doing the same thing for quite a long time. And, you know, all of those struggles are valuable, important, because they can change not just consciousness, but policy.
I was surprised to learn that three states house about half of the country's death row inmates, Texas, Florida, not surprisingly, but also California, which I think of as a progressive state politically.
It's back to politics. I mean, if you look at the numbers of people on death row, California has about 745. And that's down from a high of about 800 a few years ago. And while that is surprising, I mean, look at the population of California. It's like a country. It's 40 million people or so. The southern states, I think, are playing an historical game about the devaluation of Black life and the continuing oppression of Black people in the name of a hidden kind of white supremacy. But, you know, it is not a democratic thing. It is an American thing. And that's why people need to think in terms of what Angela Davis has famously called abolition democracy and the abolition of the very prison itself.
Mumia, can you describe what it felt like for all those years that you were on death row when news came out that a person had been put to death by the state?
Well, it wasn't news in the sense of you reading a newspaper. It was someone that you saw when you went to the shower or went to a visit or occasionally went to the cages in the yard. These were people who lived near you, got a death warrant, and as a general rule, a lot of white guys did not fight. They were traumatized. They were incredibly lonely because, let's face it, death rows are black communities. They're like projects in a sense. And they felt alienated. So they ran to death to get away from that community. But these were people that you saw, that you knew, that you may have talked to or may have been friends with. So it wasn't like you read a paper or heard it on the radio or saw it on the news. This was a person, a real living person that you saw. And it was always, I think, in every case, you know, a kind of in-your-face trauma that the state inflicts, not just on the person that they execute, that's true, not just on their family, but on everyone who knows this person, everyone who sees this person. It was a spreading toxin of terrorism, state terrorism.
Conversely, I know that Pennsylvania has had several death inmates exonerated, and I guess melancholy about that, there's happiness, of course, but also everyone on death row must know the injustices in the faulty system of the mechanics of imposing death. It must be bittersweet.
Well, it has those elements, but it also, think about this, for no person that I know of has this been a quick transition. There's been cases where people have spent 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24 years on death row only to be exonerated. Think about that. You know, there have been guys who fought for over a decade to get DNA evidence, and the state fought them tooth and nail, or the state acquired the evidence and lost it. Oops. These are documented cases, you see. So, yeah, it's bittersweet, but it shows you the fallibility, right? The human failures of administrators, of human institutions, like death row.
Mumia, do you have any hope for the Biden administration vis-a-vis capital punishment and policy changes?
It's too early, I think, right now, but I would say this. If someone is an activist, if they are related to Black Lives Matter or Decarcerate or All of Us or None or Amnesty International, for that matter, or any group that opposes the death penalty, don't be quiet, don't be coy. You know, raise your resistance now, because the state is the state. And raise your voice now, because there's never a time to be quiet when there's an injustice happening, when there's a social injustice happening to the weak and the poor.
Mumia, I know that you don't like to talk about your own case. You're always advocating for just about everyone else who suffered at the hands of injustice. But I do want to say that we congratulate you on a year after which the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has denied Maureen Faulkner's
You
King
have one
Fett
minute left.
Petition. Are you looking forward to some justice in the next year for you?
I certainly hope so. I haven't read anything yet, but I certainly hope so, because I've not been able to talk to my lawyer. But speaking of death row, I just got a message a few days ago that the guys up on death row were suffering from physical and mental abuse from it being cold in those cells on Death Row up at Green. And they're suffering from people who are sick with COVID. So it's one of the brothers told me that, you know, he was very, very depressed. And because they're locked up 23 and a half hours in the cell.
Torture, as you say.
Yeah.
We're going to put some numbers, Mumia, on our website. So
thank you for using Securus. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.
We're grateful to have Attorney Jim Lafferty back to do an editorial on the situation with Julian Assange. The judge in England is going to rule on January 4th on whether he should be extradited to the United States and tried as a spy. This would be killing the messenger. Julian Assange has revealed war crimes in the United States, and as a consequence, they've indicted him under the Espionage Act. Let's listen to Jim Lafferty, the host of the Lawyers Guild show and a leader of the National Lawyers Guild out in Los Angeles.
While most of the nation has been focused on the presidential election, the pandemic, the economy, or protests against racist policing, one of the most significant threats to our democracy has been unfolding in London. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange faces an unprecedented U.S. indictment for publishing sensitive information about the war in Iraq. Julian faces up to 175 years in prison for publishing stories that played, quote-unquote, possibly the most important role in catalyzing public opposition to our post-9/11 wars. In the meantime, there have been no consequences for our government officials who concealed information, lied to the public, misled the nation into wars, and broke the law. Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have been in the U.S. crosshairs ever since they released Collateral Murder, a video proving that at least three verifiable war crimes, including the murder of defenseless Reuters journalists and other civilians, had been committed by U.S. forces in Iraq. No one has been held to account for these war crimes. But the government continues to persecute and prosecute Julian Assange. They promote false claims against Assange, including that he raped two women, even though the women he supposedly raped have both publicly said that no such rape ever happened. And they've accused him of costing Hillary Clinton the 2016 election, which we now know she actually lost because she didn't bother to campaign much in Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. 7 years ago, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper lied to Congress. He was asked a very direct question, quote, does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans, close quote. Clapper replied, quote unquote, no, sir. 3 months later, we learned that Clapper was lying. NSA contractor Edward Snowden revealed that the NSA had, in fact, been spying on all U.S. citizens with Clapper's full knowledge. Those revelations, appearing in the Washington Post and other outlets, proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that Clapper committed perjury before Congress in a live broadcast to the American people. The federal courts have ruled that the programs Clapper lied about were illegal and likely unconstitutional. However, not only has Clapper never faced justice, he now has a cushy paid position as a CNN contributor. Meanwhile, Julian Assange sits in prison in London under conditions that Nils Melzer, the UN rapporteur on torture, has called, quote, torturous and illegal, close quote. In reality, Assange has been in prison for more than a decade without any conviction for any crimes, solely for simply telling the scandalous truth about the crimes of the U.S. and other governments. Whistleblowers Edward Snowden, Thomas Drake, Jeffrey Sterling, William Biney, Joseph Wilson, John Kiriakou, and Chelsea Manning have all, like Julian Assange, experienced the full weight and mendacity of the U.S. government. Was it for being drug kingpins, child traffickers, or war criminals? No, no. They were all persecuted because they shared with the American people evidence of their government's crimes and deceit. They did not steal our nuclear codes or reveal national security secrets, but rather crimes perpetrated on us and others that our government wished to never see the light of day. Part of our national character should certainly include striving to improve ourselves. Well, in the 1920s, we rounded up radicals for exercising their constitutional rights to freedom of speech and association. In the 1930s, 1940s, we turned our backs on Jewish refugees fleeing the horrors of Nazi Germany. In the 1940s, we also rounded up American citizens of Japanese ancestry and put them in those internment camps. And in the 1950s, the U.S. government, through its anti-communist witch hunts, chose to destroy the careers of the Hollywood 10 and thousands of other law-abiding Americans. In all of those shameful cases, false patriotic fervor, with the help of the government, drowned out and marginalized dissent against these anti-democratic government campaigns. It is only with hindsight and the luxury of time that we now recognize the error of our ways, but too late in those cases to make a difference. With the persecution and prosecution of Julian Assange, we now face another of those moments when our national character is challenged. But where is the hue and cry against this injustice when our president childishly attacks a news anchor on Twitter or revokes a reporter's press pass? We raise our howls of disapproval. But when a journalist is locked away and threatened with a lifetime incarceration, we shrug. As a nation, why are we sitting idly by while our government seeks to silence Julian Assange, a man who is guilty of nothing more than sharing the truth with us, a truth we are entitled to know? History will judge us harshly if we do not speak up now against this monstrous attack on freedom of the press. So if you truly care about press freedom and fearless investigative journalism, send a message to your member of Congress and to the White House demanding Assange's freedom. To find out other ways to help and to learn more about his case, go to www.assangedefense.org.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Skeptics, distrusting of the incoming Biden administration, are saying that it's out with the old, in with the older. That is, that the old neoliberal crew from the Obama-Clinton days are back in power and that little will change, nothing fundamental. They are especially concerned about the impending climate catastrophe, systemic racism, the threat of nuclear war, the shifting of wealth from the bottom to the top, and the never-ending forever wars. The Center for Constitutional Rights has developed a comprehensive program to challenge all of this. It is called a Rights-Based Vision for the First 100 Days. Here to speak with us is the Center for Constitutional Rights Advocacy Director, Attorney Nadia Ben-Youssef. She is a graduate of Princeton University and the Boston College of Law. She has worked with the Adala Justice Project for Palestine Rights in the Negev in southern Israel.
Nadia, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So in a nutshell, can you please tell us what you seek in your vision for the first 100 days?
You know, in a nutshell, our first 100-day demands, so these are demands that we're making to President-elect Biden and the 117th Congress, are what we've defined as kind of necessary steps that they must take immediately to begin to shift power back to the people. We're talking about, you know, what are the first things that this new administration can do, should do, must do to protect human rights of the people. And so we broke it down a bit into some broad categories, kind of what is the most urgent thing, both materially to impact the well-being and of our communities, and kind of thinking a bit more about the root cause of some of these challenges and seeing what are the steps that can be taken, can be taken immediately. And we talked about, you know, an affirmative and equitable COVID-19 response as a first step. Though SCCR is thinking about what our policy demands are, our second category of work is really about reparations, is really about repair and remedy for historical injustice. It's becoming kind of a central demand for CCR, for our communities, for our movement partners. And that's a 100-day demand. We're talking about investing in safe communities, divesting from criminalization. And this is really about community safety. We're talking about foreign policy, and we're talking about a commitment to human rights. We released this on International Human Rights Day, so that was December 10th, which was significant and intentional. These demands are really rooted in our human rights obligations and point us towards a vision of global solidarity and really kind of upending the neoliberal world order that has devastated our communities.
Nadia, what is your answer to critics who say that the CCR demands are impractical? And if they're impractical, why bother asking for them in the first place?
Oh, Michael, what a great question. And you're pointing to a CCR value, honestly, a CCR value that we are not limited by what is practical. We don't set our sight on what is possible in the realm of policy, in the realm of law. We set our sights and our demands onto what is necessary. Refusing to ask for crumbs, I think, you know, a CCR motto in our legal work is success without victory. And part of that is articulating the world that we want, insisting that power be relinquished and redistributed, insisting that hierarchies be upended, you know, insisting on the world that we know is possible, that we know that we deserve. And we're trying to shake that conversation up in the Beltway as well, which is the land of practicality. And we know that what is practical is devastating. We know that the status quo is intolerable. And without fundamental change, we are in this, you know, really devastating reality, particularly for communities who are marginalized and minoritized and criminalized.
Nadia, we love the book Success Without Victory by Jules Lobel, a longtime CCR cooperating attorney and board member. Tell us what groups you worked with in developing these demands.
Yeah, you know, so these demands are rooted in relationships. So CCR, what we do, what Jules and our other movement lawyers think about is how our legal interventions are community determined, are client driven, are centered in the needs and the vision of our clients and our movement partners. And the same is true with our advocacy work. So we're talking about our advocacy team, which is small, but we're really thinking about what movement advocacy means. And that requires community determination about these sort of demands. So what you're seeing in this 100 days vision and the demands that we're articulating are rooted in a lot of CCR casework, and then relationships with communities on the ground, frontline defenders. So you'll see some of our cases referenced. So for example, we have a case out of Pennsylvania challenging death by incarceration sentences. So we have that here as a demand. What does it look like to abolish life without parole sentencing, or what we call death by incarceration? We're working in partnership with communities in Louisiana to upend this sort of racist practice of non-unanimous juries. So you're going to see our reference to Jim Crow juries in here. We're working with partners across the country to decarcerate prisons, detention centers, and jails. So, you know, when we talk about divesting from criminalization and investing in safe communities, we're talking about those demands. And so really you're seeing a reflection of CCR community priorities and what our partners on the ground in our casework and in the advocacy are asking, which is how we believe that policy has to be written, right? These are demands of the people. It's the obligation of the government to uphold and comply with those demands.
We're speaking with Nadia Ben Youssef from the Center for Constitutional Rights about their vision for the first 100 days, the demands put to the Biden administration. Nadia, you wrote that the current moment is promising. How so?
Right. I mean, there's a few things to say about that. One is that this is a moment of really unspeakable loss and grief and heartache and tragedy. And so we don't take optimism lightly. It really is about insisting on the world that we want and trying to chart paths forward in policy, in law, in organizing, in art, to get us closer to that world. And I think optimism fuels that work. Optimism, you know, you believe that we can create the structures that we need to get us to that world. And, you know, I really do believe that in this moment of devastation, there are openings, there are transformations that have happened in our society. And I think many of those changes, whether it's how we relate to one another as community, all the mutual aid networks, all the new and bold demands around abolishing the prison industrial complex and the military industrial complex, that's kind of seeping into the mainstream in new ways. I think we want to take advantage of that piece, and I think allow the moment to transform us and to transform our demands. And so I do think that there is an opening. Certainly it's led by movement. Movement has gotten us here. And we just need to push. We need to push and be bold and not self-limit ourselves in terms of what we believe is possible right now.
I'm curious, has the center ever had a director of advocacy?
No, so not in this form. And the advocacy team is kind of consolidating. We're learning and thinking about who we are and how we can move our issues forward and move the demands and vision of our communities forward. And CCR, as you know, is a legal shop, is doing bold and uncompromising litigation on behalf of and with communities. And the advocacy arm in more recent history has supported that litigation, has supported the communities, but really tied to the litigation piece. And now we're trying to think about and make a bit of a shift, both internally at CCR, but I think on the left, from a position and a posture of reactivity and resistance and defensiveness towards kind of an offensive strategy. And I think at its best, advocacy is that. Advocacy is the affirmative demands that you put forward. It's shifting, you know, the center of gravity towards the world that we want, articulating what that is, rather than simply resisting the world that we have. And I think together, the legal work and the advocacy work are kind of working in tandem and towards this kind of larger aim and larger vision of what we're trying to achieve and what our communities are demanding. So it's a shift, and it's so exciting. And it's an incredible team to work with and to learn from every day. I'm honored to be a part of it.
Nadia, what do you advocate as an equitable COVID response?
Great question. And it's on all of our minds, I'm sure. So, you know, what we're seeing come out of Congress and what we've seen since the pandemic began and was ravaging communities, and particularly those communities most marginalized, what we've been seeing out of Congress is not an equitable COVID-19 response. And so when we're thinking about that, and we sent a letter to Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer in May of this year, as the CARES Act was being crafted, and there we were also, you know, really indicting these sort of short-term fixes to these long structural injustices and what we were calling state-created harms that existed before the pandemic. So you have these CARES responses that are falling so short of the needs of our communities and prioritizing, as we see, corporate profit, corporate impunity over the needs of people. And so we're pushing back against these sort of government policies. And our COVID, you know, what an equitable response would be is certainly first to prioritize those most vulnerable. Using a rights-based approach that's responsive to the far-reaching crisis. So it's not the pandemic exposed, as we know, exposed and exacerbated and magnified existing harms. And so what it would look like to prioritize those most vulnerable to a pandemic like COVID-19 is enacting universal health care, is broadening unemployment insurance. It's vastly increasing food aid programs, expanding childcare, canceling debt, implementing a moratorium on evictions. You know, COVID-19, where we saw, you know, such intense and continue to see such intense devastation is in carceral settings. So in order to respond to COVID-19, we have to talk about decarceration. We have to release people from prisons, jails, and detention centers. You know, and I think broadly, the COVID-19 response is both immediate, answering the material needs of people now in a meaningful way, prioritizing those who are most vulnerable, both physically and economically, to the harms of this moment, and then asking, why is this happening? Why is this happening? And addressing that. And I think that's what our framework around COVID-19 takes into consideration.
Nadia Ben-Yosef, in fashioning your visions for the first 100 days, you call the U.S. healthcare system a state-created danger. Why did you call it that?
Yeah. So here's what's happening with the state-created danger. These are what we're thinking about is the harms that existed before the pandemic. So a state-created danger is one where communities are made vulnerable or at risk of harm by deliberate and intentional policies of the state. So the state is making people vulnerable. The state is making people more vulnerable to disease, to economic devastation through policy decisions to not provide universal health coverage, to not protect a person's fundamental human right to protect themselves, to lead healthy lives, to fulfill their potential. And so I think the concept of a state-created danger, which is a legal concept, but it helps us understand what was in place that made people vulnerable to this disease, but also to made people more vulnerable to sort of harms of existing in a society that's not protecting your fundamental right to health. And so we're eager to really dig into that and to offer policymakers a framework for understanding the urgency of providing healthcare coverage, of enacting universal health coverage for people in order to protect human rights. And I think the framework of state-created danger really paints that urgency, similar to, you know, we're talking about these sort of government policies that are being proposed where corporate profit is prioritized over human health, over people, and really looking at international law obligations as well. We knew as we entered this pandemic, we knew who would be most harmed. We knew, because those are the people who are less insured, those are people who are underinsured, those are the people who don't have access to needed medical care. We knew that these would be the hardest hit and most disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. And I think with that knowledge, you can start to understand through the lens of international law, through the lens of history, these government policies as crimes against humanity that would fit under the definition of the Rome Statute of intentionally causing great suffering or injury to people on a widespread or systemic basis, right? And I think these sort of frameworks need to be put to decision makers explicitly and urgently and regularly to understand the magnitude of the harm that they are complicit with as they're passing these policies that don't take into account people's needs.
Nadia, you write that $100 billion spent on state and local police is not keeping communities safe. What would?
Heidi, that's a great question. And that's what the dreamers are putting forward in our society. That's what artists are talking about. That's what organizers and activists are imagining, that community safety is not about police. It's not about a military budget. It's not about bans and borders and walls. Community safety is about human rights being fulfilled. Community safety is when people have what they need to live full and healthy lives. Community safety happens when people are thriving. Community safety is when people have food and shelter and homes, who have access to education and access to healthcare. You know, so we're thinking about community-based services, infrastructure. This is the response to the need for human security. It's about social and economic rights being fulfilled, and that fundamental shift is the moment that we're in, where we're looking at our national priorities and recognizing the need to fundamentally recalibrate. And it's an exciting time, honestly. I'll just say this sort of invest, divest framework comes to us from the Movement for Black Lives, who in 2016, through their vision for Black Lives, really pushed this framework, which has helped us really think about what it is we need to destroy, in this case, criminalization of communities, and what do we need to build in its place? And here's the concept of safe communities and community safety.
In the CCR vision document, it's written that, quote, racial capitalism and imperialism require the mass criminalization, incarceration, and surveillance of people. What is it in your program that addresses this?
You know, at each stage of the vision that we're putting forward, we're first upending and focusing on the lie that is the hierarchy of human life. We're challenging policies and laws and regulations that are premised on the criminalization of communities, of individuals, of people, and identifying those moments. I think we're chipping away at the large and the underlying harm that is racial capitalism in this country and imperialism. So we're chipping away at those pieces. In terms of imperialism, we're really talking about what does a rights-based foreign policy look like, where the United States, an imperial country, a colonial country, fundamentally refigures its role and its position in the global community, from one now of domination, impunity, mass criminalization towards solidarity and accountability fundamentally. I mean, accountability for the harm that it's creating. And I think this sort of fundamental reimagining is underpins many of our demands. And so we have at the vision, you know, in our vision of what the world that we want, the destruction of these economic and political regimes of oppression and pointing towards steps that can be taken now to start dismantling that infrastructure of mass criminalization and achieving human rights.
Nadia, what would a rights-based immigration policy look like?
Heidi, first of all, no borders. Really, though, I mean, you know, what does it look like to protect freedom of movement, to protect the right to move, to leave, to return, and to belong? If that was our aim, you know, the idea of a militarized border, the idea of detention would have to be abolished with this concept of borders. And I think we're a rights-based immigration approach. I mean, we have here ways to chip away at the harm of the immigration regime. You know, but these institutions of harm and criminalization have to be fundamentally abolished. We can't have these agencies like ICE, like DHS, that are premised on the criminalization of entire communities, and you know, uphold international law obligations. You know, the U.S. immigration policy really is in violation of international law norms. Certainly, under the Trump administration, who has completely disregarded fundamental principles of non-refoulement or asylum norms. So, you know, a first step is to roll back these sort of destructive and overtly racist, xenophobic policies that the Trump administration has put on. But it is to recognize that our immigration regime fundamentally is about criminalization, fundamentally is about restricting the right to movement, the right to belong, and has to be reconfigured.
With respect to a rights-based foreign policy, I wanted to ask you about repealing, as the Visions document calls for, repealing the 2001 and the 2002 authorizations for the use of military force. I remember when Bush Jr. propounded those authorizations, Michael Ratner responded saying this is really the first step towards a military dictatorship, and you and the Visions have called for their repeal. Could you talk about that, please?
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for lifting up Michael Ratner and his visionary approach to, you know, anti-militarism and really rooting CCR in anti-militarism and anti-imperialism as a beacon of our work. So repealing and not replacing the authorization for use of military force or the AUMF is a longstanding demand of CCR. You know, these were put in place in 2001, 2002, backbone of the war on terror, quote unquote. Over the course of the years, there's been different proposals. How do we make this slightly less terrible for communities around the world? How do we limit executive power? And here we're really in the spirit of abolition, talking about there can be no reform of the AUMF. There can be no reform of these kinds of authorizations. And they have to be fundamentally repealed and not replaced. And so you'll see that demand from CCR for many years and wanted to take the opportunity to just put forward that demand once again and reiterate our anti-militarism and anti-imperial perspective around foreign policy.
Nadia, we just have a couple of minutes remaining, but on two other issues that were dear to Michael Ratner's heart, do you advocate closing Guantanamo and stopping targeted killings and armed drone attacks?
Absolutely, Heidi. Absolutely. The spirit of Michael lives on at CCR, and we're honored to work in his legacy. And absolutely, you're going to see, and we'll share with you and your listeners very soon, because January 11th is the 19th anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo. And together with partners, we'll be putting forward kind of the steps that Biden can take to immediately close Guantanamo. We're imagining the end of Guantanamo in our vision and together with our clients who are still there 19 years on. We are imagining relief. We can, this is now Biden's responsibility. This is on his watch and the watch of his administration that this prison continues to exist. And we believe that it can be closed, and we know it can be. And Biden can really take clear, immediate steps to do that. So you definitely see that here. And in terms of the U.S.'s approach to domination through military force and how it continues to reimagine what that means, whether it's drone killings and technology surveillance and these sort of things, we're following how the military continues to reinvent its abilities to oppress and to dominate and to criminalize communities and create violence and havoc around the world.
Nadia Ben-Yosef, we've unfortunately come to the end of our allotted time. It's been very, very good having you on Law and Disorder to talk about the CCR's new document, Visions for the First 100 Days. Nadia, how can our listeners get a hold of that demand?
Well, thank you, Michael and Heidi, for having me. It's such a privilege and an honor to speak with you. Yeah, you can check it out on our website, ccrjustice.org. It'll lead you to the First 100 Days document, and follow us on social media, where you'll get snippets of it on Instagram and on Twitter. And we'll be rolling out a policy agenda in the spring that just expands on the First 100 Days demands and sets forward the affirmative vision that we're moving towards. So stay tuned and get ready to win. We are everything that we need, and eager to do this work with you all.
Well said. Thank you so much, Nadia, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. We'll be right back.
Thank you.